Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the Creekside Room, Anne Kelleher is speaking on ethnic conflicts. So let's listen in on Anne Kelleher.
What I'm hoping to do in the next couple, three, whatever time I've got, is to get us maybe talking to each other about some of these issues that we'll be discussing and about whether the framework works or not or whatever. My goal is to establish today and then to repeat two or three times, because education is setting up skills, actually. Analysis are a set of skills, and skills have to be practiced. I know that people perceive of higher education or education in general as getting ready to do something in the real world. Okay? You have to have this certification, which is a college degree, and then you go out and do whatever, and then you leave college. Well, I don't think of college that way, and I don't think of formal education that way. So I'll be giving you a mini course on how to analyze international issues. Because I do believe that education is to set up a set of skills that you repeat and repeat and repeat all your life. And that's what we're about. We just don't sit in our little enclaves, although some of us, I guess, do, even at PLU, and train people who are specialists and then go out and do whatever it is we train them to do. Most of the students I have will not be political scientists. So if I try to turn them into political scientists, I'm not doing anybody a favor, including them, myself, whatever. So I see education for lifelong learning is my goal at a general education institution like PLU. So I'm hoping I achieve some of that here. We're going to do a mini course in understanding how to think about the news is the thing I chose, but we could think about a whole variety of other things. And the key then to think about is, what is it that a trained academic can do for you? Now, not a lot, maybe, but hopefully, since I am thinking in terms of general education and terms of lifelong learning skills, that I have established something of a framework that I've used in my courses and I've used for continuing education courses and other things over the years that other people have found useful, all right? Actually, some people think of higher education institutions as dispensing information. And I don't think that's the main thing you do. If you want to find information about any international issue, you probably would not necessarily go to an academic or higher ed educational institution. There's plenty of information. There are interest groups falling all over themselves trying to provide you with information. In fact, there's probably too much, in a way, of detailed factual information available fairly easily to everybody. What isn't available is the one thing that an academic is trained to do, is to sort out that information. What of all this stuff is useful for me to think about, to come up with new ideas, or to really understand the meaning of what's happening in the world? Okay, so that's my general goal, to set up a framework, to give you the categories that are pulled out of my discipline plus a few others, that at least people in the past have found relatively useful to bring new ideas to mind. Your measure of whether I'm successful is whether you've seen a relationship of the actors or the events that are going on in a specific case study that we'll use here that you hadn't thought about that way before. And if I manage that, I've done something useful. So if we can, just so we all sort of know who's around, so you can, if you really get all excited about the Middle East, or I want to use Bosnia, you know, if you're going to have a model that works, you might as well get about the most complex situation you can find. So we'll see, sorting out Bosnia would be fun. I went to Albania this summer, so I have a few other different sort of slants on it than I think I would have otherwise. So let's go around and see, could you please give your name and what part of the country, the United States, I'm assuming, for most of you, you're from? We start here, please.
Bill Dorey, Dakota.
Oh, yes? Okay. Shall we go around the back row then?
Oh, Mary Stoneman, Bakersfield,
California.
Joanne Hull from Greenbelt, Maryland.
That's about that. You can't go much further in this country from there, can you?
Yeah, that's
yeah. Right. Yeah.
Marilyn Hanson, Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Roger Hanson.
Cedar Falls, Iowa. Yes, sir.
Dan Benson, Fullerton, Southern California.
Mary Jane Rice, Jan Patterson, Seattle, was that?
3 miles downriver.
Oh, gold. I should know that.
Andy Anderson from Grant, Washington.
Larry Howie from Natchez.
Stan Sanderson, Federal Way.
Cliff Rowell, Pacific Luther.
Yeah. A place.
You live there.
Yeah.
Sometimes
you
I feel
really
like.
You really get the feeling.
Jim Zimmerman from Kent, Washington.
Tom Wilson from Spokane.
Karen Wilson, Spokane.
Sue Johnson, Shelton, Washington.
From Carl Johnson, Shelton, near Olympic, near Olympic.
Yes.
Shelton is a small place. We have had more students from Shelton.
Ruth Doherty from Tacoma. Martin Master from Newark.
Great. Believe it or not, this is like a cross-section of the classes I have. Preponderant Washington State, a few people from those wild outlying places. We have very few from as wild outlying as Maryland, but I had one from Memphis, Tennessee once. All right, so that's rather, I think, typical as far as places where people come from, and that matters in your thinking about the news, and I'll get to that as the last point. Because actually, in some ways, it should be the first point, and just a better, when you begin thinking about these issues, the categories I have, you start to think holistically with them, so that the issue itself and all the things that you have to think about and sort out in your mind become almost instinctive, and you can't go 1, 2, 3, 4, but when you start out getting skills and categories, you have to go 1, 2, 3, 4. And the fifth one I've got is, what is your perspective? Because that is your filter. Everything you see and hear out there in the world is filtered through a perspective you have, which comes from all different kinds of beliefs, cultural values, where you're from, your interests, your occupation, all these sort of things come together to give you a certain, every time you hear something happen, generally you have a reaction. That's human. It's partly intellectual, it's partly emotional. So your own perspective is something that you have to distill. So why am I reacting this way? Oh yeah, I think this. That's a handy checklist thing to have in your head. Know what your beliefs about the economic issues, the ethnic human rights issues, the other issues in the world are, and then in some ways you have to say, all right, I think this, that gives me a prejudice to understand this issue from this point of view. Let's see what the others are. It's okay to keep your own. I'm not saying that's bad, but if you're going to really understand issues, you have to see as clearly as you can the point of view that you don't agree with. And the Bosnian thing for Americans generally is the point of view of the Serbs. Now you can certainly reject it, but our news is really biased in the direction of understanding the Bosnian government / Muslim point of view as the underdogs. They might not be underdogs for long, according to a military attaché in the United States and the Army. All right, I digress. All right, let's see if we can do this thing now. So I'll be talking at you for a bit, and then I'll be asking, see if we can pull out from this group, fill in the categories for Bosnia, and see if with shared information, we can flesh out and understand that issue a little better by the end of the hour. So this is my framework.
Are you implying that some of us are not completely unbiased?
Nobody is. I mean, everybody is biased. Sure. I mean, you begin to think about issues with all your own, and that's of course. Of course. But then the issue is, if you're going to come up with, you know, because in these issues, America is supposed to have a solution, or it's supposed to be on the positive side somehow, right? Because we're a very powerful country in the world, and that sort of is what we're supposed to do. Because we have worldwide interests, and we're the only country with military power worldwide, we're the one called on. So I think it behooves America, participatory democracy the United States is, to sort this out. So, of course, every single person is, by including the policymakers.
Well, let me ask you, isn't that even though the advice is current, there are still some absolute rights and wrong?
We don't do that in political science. Yeah, I did. So sooner or later in class, I'll somebody, I say, yes, absolutely. And that is where you as an individual human being, because you know Christian ethical system, I know really believing Christians who totally disagree with each other on international issues. So to say that I bring it, which I do, a Christian bias to these issues, doesn't say what I really think should happen in each issue. Our Christians can argue with each other as much as Muslims and Buddhists and fascists don't argue with each other very often. They have a way to sort that out. It's like follow the leader, okay? Right, no problem. But most other belief systems, be they political or religious or whatever, will get people in that system disagreeing with each other because the system is so flexible as to allow disagreement when you get to the very specific issues. Oh, I think most of us in this room, maybe not all, but most of us would bring a Christian bias, and I happen to think that's a healthy thing. But it doesn't say what we're going to think about what to do in Bosnia or with U.S.-Japan trade problems or whatever. Yeah. No, we're doing political science, a little economics maybe, a little other things, but social science and humanities, well, not humanities, so social science and natural science very much says we're dealing with day-to-day specific issues. Now, the large metaphysical, ethical questions, those philosophers and religion people deal with. So the way we avoid in social science having to sort that out is to say, that's your issue. You know, what you personally really believe. And with most political issues, I find myself very flexible because I'm a pragmatic. I don't bring ethical content to many of these political issues until I get to what I personally would do. So the whole analysis part, I try to really say, all right, how would a Serb really think about this? How would a person from Croatia, whatever their political, think about this, all right? Because if you don't do that, you're going to distort the whole issue. You need to know what people think and believe who disagree with yourself. Or, by inherently, you'll set up an answer that won't work. There's one thing I can get across as we go through the issues in this analysis is that. Because if you do not accommodate to someone who disagrees with you on a political issue, what happens? You get dogmatic, you get entrenched, and you don't get a solution. Therefore, internationally, you get war. And I personally think that's unethical. So my ethics says, listen to somebody who disagrees, even if it just seems whacked out to start with. What do they really want? What do they really believe? What do they really think? Is there anything in there that you can use from what you believe to come up with a common ground? If there isn't, that's the political skill of a foreign policymaker, of a domestic politician. So that's what I mean about taking this ethical question and keeping over here for a second as you begin thinking and really try to, and it's an ethic with me. What? Is there anything at all credible in somebody who disagrees with me in their point of view? Anything at all? And then try to work for them. And if you don't do that, then your politics are polarized and dangerous. So let's say, and unfortunately we have a lot of policymakers who don't seem to really operate from that assumption, and therefore we get into really hard and fast positions that it's hard to maneuver out of. Dogmatism doesn't work very well in politics, unless of course you want to send in the Marines all the time. If you do all the time, they're useful on occasion. All right, starting place. And this might seem utterly simple. Why is the woman ranting about this? Who are the major players? Okay, I have three areas of complexity in thinking about international issues. Believe it or not, that's a very complex thing. Because internationally, it wouldn't be an international issue if you only had one level of players. Right? If you're going to say in the Bosnia situation, who are the players? Well, we have Bosnian Muslims, Bosnian Croats, and Bosnian Serbs. Bingo. Now, if that's all there were, might be rather a manageable situation, containable. But it's not. So it gets very complex, but I have certain categories that we'll try to sort out here. Okay. We have, in the area of levels of actors, we have the primary ones. In the Bosnia situation, the three I've stated are the primary ones. They are organized, they have separate identities, they have separate leaderships. If you want to sort them all out, those are the three. There's also a complicating factor there in that those three groups are highly intermarried. Almost undistinguishable, they all spoke the same language. The only thing that distinguished them is religious affiliation, which we don't understand too well, but in that part of the region, it seems like religion is such a dominant motivation. It's not. They're pretty much were detached. They were rather secular religious people in much of Bosnia and Herzegovina. A few really fervent believers, but not all that many. And they were very intermarried. 1/3 to 40% of the population in Bosnia and Herzegovina had a spouse who was of a different religion. And that's part of the tragedy in this situation. Utter tragedy. It's families that are killing each other. Extended families. I mean, the horror of it is like the American Civil War. Families in the southern part of, or even in the north, some of them, just would disagree with each other, fought on different sides. Wrenching. And it also makes it more intense. So there's the primary level, which looks rather simple, but even when you look at just those three actors, it gets complicated. Then we have the regional level. Okay. If you look at that part of the world, who else is there? Well, we have this thing called Yugoslavia, which isn't Yugoslavia anymore. It's really Serbia with a few others hanging on. We have Croatia, we have Slovenia, we have Albania. It's that Balkans thing at the turn of the century. No. What? Who are all these peoples? Well, they all have a vested interest in what happens in Bosnia. So you've got maybe 10 countries sort of surrounding everybody from Greece to Austria and in between who really have an interest. So there, that's the region of the Balkans. So you've got a whole bunch of more actors who all side with certain of the three elements. Croatia obviously gives money and arms and support to, guess who? The Croatians, now self-identified in Bosnia, and the Serbs, Serbia, and rump Yugoslavia gives support. All right, so you've got a support system which exacerbates the problem, gives these conflicting parties outside military and economic support, much less political support, and keeps the thing going, makes it more intense as well. And then, if that were all, it still might be manageable, except for you've got the global level, meaning people very far away, like in Washington, D.C., Paris, London, okay? These places have a direct interest as well in what is about to occur in Bosnia and have gotten their noses right into it via the United Nations, via the European Community. So you've got another level of actors that multiply even more the amount of political, economic, and military attention that's given to this region. I mean, Iran and Saudi Arabia are filtering weapons and have been continually to the Bosnian Muslims. And if you know any, and look at that unholy alliance, if you will. Saudi Arabia and Iran, what else do they agree on in the world? Nothing. Almost nothing. These two are at loggerheads all over the place, in the Central Asian republics of Russia and everywhere. Well, they both are supporting the same side in Bosnia-Herzegovina and have been smuggling arms in various ways into the area. Right. Just now that is legion, the number of outside interests in outside countries. Now, as far as classifications in the region we're speaking of, we've got two main ones, states involved, which all those actors I said, remember I ran down a few, almost all of them are states. That's almost always the key actor, but to show how complex the international system has become, if this were the 19th century, by the way, all you'd have to do is say states, and that's it. I wouldn't have any more others there. But the world is much different and harder to analyze because since World War II, we've got regional intergovernmental organizations, okay? Regional ones like the European Community. Right? It's a regional organization. The headquarters of the European Community has some impetus to solve things, get its members agreeing. It has a force of its own. And Universal Intergovernmental Organizations, that's the United Nations. There are others for economic issues, like the World Bank and others. But for this issue specifically, it's that. All right, now, your reaction should be, how is one human being who has a lot to do in life? You know, you have jobs, you have children, you have families, you have things to do. How can I possibly sort all this out and spend all my time that I have to spend? Well, I'm going to take a newspaper and see if we can't, even just from the news, which is to the kind of level of analysis I'll be doing, not the absolute best, but it's a starting place, and it does provide almost every single article with who are the actors. And if you read several news articles over time, you pick an issue and start to follow it because you're interested, you can almost always at least isolate the actors and their relationships with each other. And that's the key starting place. Because the relationship, if you sort this out, you've already got a handle. These people are directly involved. Their survival, their economic vitality, they can't back off. This situation will not leave. They can't come in and come out. So their interests are primary in understanding the problem. That's where to start. Then you overlap these. The last one that you should think of is the United States policy. Before you do it, as a discipline for your head to figure out an international conflict, don't be saying what our government's doing, what it's not doing, whatever. That's the last thing to think about. The first thing is to understand this situation. Pretend you're from Mars. You're not an American citizen with responsibility for what your government does. Let's take that away for a second. Set it aside in your mind. Okay? And say, all right, who are the primary actors and what do they think? Because the next set of issues are their interests. Okay? Very important. And that first one almost everybody ignores. Now, I happen to read the New York Times, and one of the reasons I love to read the New York Times isn't necessarily because I'm from New York, although that might be an addiction I picked up early on in life, I'm not sure, but it almost always, as it's starting to analyze or starting to give you information, has a little map. How nice. It's the beginning place. Where countries are in relation to each other is almost always ignored in the analysis you hear in the news or wherever. It's a starting place, and it has to be there because that's where an interest is decided. In large extent, who borders on who and who claims part of who else? Crucial to figure out these issues and where they all live. But it's the thing you can't change in an international conflict situation. Who you happen to live next to. We happen in the United States to have been so fortunate for so long to border on a country with whom we have really, since 1842 anyway, had not had military tensions, Canada. Amazing history, unique. It distorts Americans' point of view toward conflicts because we've got a country on our border with whom for well over 150 years and our major development years, we didn't get in a fight. Do you know how few countries in the world can say that? Almost none. Well, Britain, but then it gets in fights with France all the time, so you don't even have to border on a country to get into a fight. Borders tend to lead to problems. They don't solve them. And that's up to the Americans. So geography is crucial. Who's on your border? What are the interests that are different? Some people claim pieces of each other. Both countries do that for historical and ethnic reasons. We are different from that. And we also had at our southern border somebody with whom we had big differences, but we were so much more powerful. If you think the Mexicans have forgotten the Mexican War, forget it. They know it. We've sort of forgotten it. Mexican War, what?
Southern California is
out. Oh, yeah. It's coming back, isn't it? Yeah, Mexico was reduced in size by half. See, Mexicans get it. The first thing you think of is geography, because you can be reduced as a country if you lose. No, see, we don't think when you move that way. So geography is really crucial. And these are the other parts of interest. Economic. If you're looking, say, at the Bosnian situation, one thing you sort of lose track of, but it's crucial, is you see the properties that are being taken, you know, when the Muslims are thrown out of a particular region, who's throwing them out? the local people who live next to them. Now, why would they do that? Sheer ethnic hatred? No, they can take the property. It's rather obvious, but crucial. So it's a real temptation. When you hear of ethnic cleansing, well, you don't call it that if you're a Serb. You say, wow, throw the Muslims out of there, looking around. Well, you know what these people did to my father? You start to build up a rationale in your mind. They're different from us. Well, they're really not, because we're all intermarried with you, but no. In your mind, you say, back several hundred years ago, this and this, and you begin to build up a rationale. You think they don't deserve to live there. Besides, your family can take it over. Shops, buildings. Of course, after you really get in a nice bloody war, there's not much to take over. So, in the long run, economics usually leads to everybody having a reduced standard of living and occupation. But for the people immediately, and look at the kind of people that are in these militias that started out by doing the cleansing. It was pretty spontaneous. We think of it maybe as Belgrade planned it. But if you look at each specific town where the Serbian local forces, most of them not trained, not military, got weapons from the Serbs outside of Bosnia, and they were then better armed, and what did they do? Force out their neighbors. And only ethnic hatred doesn't explain all of that. Greed explains a large part of that. So there's certain levels of analysis that you just have to pause a minute, think it over. What economic interests are there in this conflict? Who's getting, what are their positions? And who's getting the benefit of the changes that are being taken place? And then there's this. This and this should go together. You know, why the fight over certain cities in Bosnia? It's where they are. Muslim enclave on a hill overlooking the major river that Serbs think they need. Yeah. And the Drina River as well. These are crucial towns because of their military strategic value. No, there isn't a whole lot else involved in these. Right? And that's why the Muslims don't want to move out of those. And they've kept their own people as hostages in a way in these, and not wanted to deport them or pull them out of these cities, leave them there, because that's the only thing that keeps the West interested. There's a lot of that in Sarajevo as well. So there's certain very strategic things about geography to keep in mind, and the political linkages. Interests are related to who sees their own power as reduced if. Now, why is the United States and the Bush administration said we don't have anything to do with Bosnia? Eagleburger, who was the last Secretary of State under Bush, really bright, highly conservative, very straightforward guy, you said, wait a minute, you know what's going to happen if we get involved? Forget it. We are not sending peacekeepers, we're not getting involved. Now, Clinton came in and they were all sorting themselves out. What?
He was also the former ambassador to Yugoslavia.
Yeah, and he understood what the Serbs were after. And they weren't going to stop. So you don't want to get in the right way of a steamroller, I suppose, is part of the point of view. Absolutely. Well, the Clinton administration came in, and they all scratched their heads and weren't quite sorting things out. And so, well, all right, what we'll do is, right? And then a policy statement was made. And as soon as the United States made a policy statement, which was very pro-Muslim, then what happens? As soon as a country takes a position that's big and powerful and rich, then everybody expects them to do something. Oh dear, we've sided with someone. And then it looks like we're diminished in influence and power if our team, the one we've tentatively sided with, doesn't do well. And the Muslims didn't do well. Did very badly, as a matter of fact, got cleansed out of other places. Sarajevo got circled, all this. So the United States' interest becomes its political influence, which is directly related to this. That's another lecture I won't go into. Right? So, as soon as a large, powerful outside country, Germany doesn't do this very often because it doesn't want to send its troops anywhere. Japan will just make money, thank you very much. You know, we don't want to get into these things. Japan, because it knows the United States will go tramping around and make sure the Iraqis don't stop the flow of oil and other things, so we'll just let the United States do it. that. But the United States tends to get itself into all these things because we have so many global interests, and part of the interests are political. Because if the United States is seen to support the Bosnian Muslims and they end up disappearing or non-influential or lose, and for them it's survival, right? Then what do other peoples in the world who seek United States support think? So once we've committed ourselves to somebody somewhere, we've got a real level of power issue here. Because we want to be influential in the world, we have worldwide economic interests, worldwide strategic interests, we need friends. We need people we can work through. How would we have fought the war against Iraq without Saudi Arabian bases? Okay? You have to have connections in the world to keep up your level of the flow of oil in this case, your economic, your strategic position. So we can't be seen as backing off or not supporting effectively people that we side with.
You use the word friends between nations.
Oh, that is very different from friends among people, that's right. What we mean when we say that in international relations are countries that are open to listen to us and to establish their political positions commensurate with ours. Albania. We are speaking to the United States head of embassy in Albania, not the ambassador in the next level down, the political policymaker, in effect, for the American embassy. And he said, quote, and then he caught himself after he said this, but he looked, he says, they listen to us very well, like Albania's government. Every single policy of the Albanian government is exactly what American policy wants them to have. Keep the lid on. Don't fight in Kosovo. Don't cause ethnic problems with Greece. Okay? Keep the lid on. Keep it quiet. And we'll have some aid coming and all those other good things that the Americans can bring about.
Quid pro quo.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I question the use of the word friends as used between countries.
That's fine.
Britain is a special case, but what is Britain?
Yeah. All right, maybe commonality of interest. And it's the commonality of interest of the leadership of that country, sometimes not the people. Oh, and I'll tell you what gets more complex. If you want to do Haiti, then there's the leadership of Haiti being military people. Well, now listen, those military people have friends in the Pentagon, and I mean real friends, who are feeding them all this anti-Clinton stuff. And they're quoting it to American journals. Right? Then there's Aristide, who nobody seems to like, but we're stuck supporting him somehow. All right, that's another story. All right, so the American government is very split. Many State Department people feel themselves needing to support Aristide. Many military people support the military leaders of Haiti. Hey, so we have two friends in and around Haiti, and it's causing us a lot of problems coming up with a policy. But you're right. But that word is, in fact, used as sort of a jargon word in international relations. You see it in the press and in the papers all the time. And you're right, it does not mean the common sense definition of friend doesn't fit at all. All right, so interest, and interest means the first time you start to think about something, you find out where it is on the map. You find out how it relates geographically to other countries involved in the situation and the conflict. And that's a starting place. Then you look and see who's going to benefit from certain kinds of results of the conflict. And you've got an interest level. Now, that is hard enough in some ways because here are the actors, and you figure out what their geostrategic interest is, and then you figure their economic interest. But there's something that makes this much more complex to analyze. Right there, we're all pretty straightforward. It's just a matter of finding the information. Next thing is where we end up with what I would call the second major complexity. Oh, well, that's great. Yeah? We can find our piece of paper and sort ourselves up. Which is this one. Perceptions. Whoa. Here we're getting to the amorphous emotional stuff. It's one thing to say that Serbs in Bosnia, many of them perceive themselves as benefiting economically if they can get rid of their Muslim neighbors and Croat neighbors. Croats, in their part, see themselves as benefiting if they get rid of their Muslim neighbors in Mostar. Some of the nicest parts of Mostar, that city, were lived in by Muslims, and the Croats wanted it. And the Muslims are doing the same thing. You know, they're getting rid of Croats. Okay? So everybody sees themselves as economically and in various limited lifestyles and whatever benefit. It's one thing to say that, it's another thing to say, but why really do they want to kill each other? Why do they perceive themselves as having to use that tactic to get their way? Well, now we're getting into this. And this means you've got to do the hard part. And this is almost, in some ways, impossible to find in the news. If you're interested in issues, you need to go past what a reporter is giving you as information, because it's not their job. In fact, they are trained and told, don't get into, keep the facts, do the facts, right? Or use direct quotes from people involved in the situation, but don't get into this analysis because it's a quagmire. Okay. Trying to figure out how people think. How do they see themselves in relations to their opponents? What are the values that they bring to bear? That's a tough question.
Yeah, but even in sticking to the facts, they filter through which facts?
Yeah. They have their own. Yeah. And that's one of the Serbs. I do know some actually intelligent, sensitive, religious, ethical Serbs. And they say, look, we do decry what some of our fellow nationals are doing to people. We don't agree with ethnic cleansing. We don't agree with these concentration camps. We don't. But there is a strong Serbian position in this conflict that Americans aren't getting. And you have to kind of really make an effort sometimes to conjure up, well, what would an ethical, believing, intelligent Serb see? What would they? And that's a question I'm presenting to you is absolutely vital to understand any international conflict. There is not a long-running conflict that I know that does not have a valid, ethically, historically, intellectually based position for various sides. If it didn't, it would be relatively easy to solve. If there were just blanket a real evil bad guy, Saddam Hussein might come close. But in many situations, and that one we sorted out pretty quickly, you know. But in many situations, it's not that easy to find who really is at heart of one of the parties to the conflict, the evil one. Like I said, it's a political thing. And in a minute, we'll try to come up with a Serbian position that makes some sense. But these, I suggest to you, are the reasons for a certain perception. And there's an emotionalism to this, and both of these lend themselves to real, human beings have a really strong, noble side, and that they need to believe in something. And sometimes what many humans start to believe in is very detrimental to other human beings. That's why we need ethics. Wait a minute. Are your beliefs the only ethical system you come up with, or if they're doing real harm to everybody, maybe it's a false ethic. So we need to think about that. But there's a very strong ethical, emotional component. And this too, every Serb you talk to takes them maybe 3 or 4 sentences, and if you really want to listen to them, they'll go back to history like a shot. Every one of the ethnic groups in this region has their own view of the history of this region, which is fraught with violence and problems. And they're all against each other. The Battle of Kosovo, I tell you, it takes maybe a few sentences for a Serb to come out with it. Well, that's the 1600s, folks. You know, and it's alive and well. That's a very different view from Americans, too. You know, using history and particular events in history as something that absolutely solidifies your view of something going on today. Americans have very little sense of history. know, unless you go to the South and you meet, as I have, daughters of the American Confederacy, they have very strong views of history and how it solidifies certain political positions today. Just visit Montgomery, Alabama, and you'll find these daughters there. It's great. I mean, it's true. I stood there and I'm looking, I'm figuring out about Jefferson Davis. They have a view of Jefferson Davis I've never seen. And so then this woman comes up and she's explaining to us, oh, they were both born in Kentucky. Lincoln, but Lincoln was totally evil and he did all these things, and Jefferson Davis was an honest man. And okay, great. And there was a big state trooper right there just smiling and staring at us, and he was as black as he could be, and it was just great. And I'm thinking, this is really America. Here we are. And he was just kind of listening and smiling away, and it's okay. You know, it's a new age. I got the uniform. It was great. I don't know what all you can do with that, but that's another thing about perception. See? When you start to notice perceptions and how people are taking things, it makes life much more interesting. Confusing, maybe, but a lot more interesting. So this, for most people in the world, except maybe Americans, is very important. And as we went through the South Balkans this summer with the students, they all remarked on how these people are mentioning 1500s as being at, what? You know, my students are all like me. They're from America, Washington State. And I said, wow, very different view of history and not empirical, let me tell you. What happened then becomes a justification for something now. And if you're a social scientist, you're in real trouble with that. But what are the facts of the benefit of the soul? That's not the point. The point isn't how it reinforces this. It's what you want to do now. And then there's always this that we sometimes neglect. The driving force often behind a foreign policy is the one that you never think about. And that's true of ours as well. What are the domestic political pressures on a leader to decide the way they're deciding? I would put money, and I don't have a lot of it, on the fact that virtually every policy, at least by our own government, is driven, not just tangentially, but driven by domestic political reality, particularly this administration. I can say some good things too. You know, it really is just there to be sorted out. There are some pluses to that. I mean, what is a democracy? This gets into question, what is a democracy? Isn't the leadership supposed to do with the people? Yeah, but the people are always of many opinions, at least in this country. Get three people in a room, you get five opinions. No, it's very American. So what is the driving force behind the policy when it's domestic? There's a lot of different forces, I suspect. And basically, it's a recipe for doing nothing. In many cases, when your domestic political structure is totally fragmented over a particular policy, then it's, well, I guess we'll wait. If you want to explain Bosnia, American policy toward Bosnia, that might be as good as anything. Why are we doing nothing or very little? Where's the domestic public opinion? Fractured. Rwanda, same thing. You know, what is a democracy? It's people, many people in this country saying, well, if we get involved in that, it'll be another Somalia, if we do this, if we do this. There's really no consensus in this country around most of these issues. And that's basically why a government does reflect its people. Not much of a policy, really. So this, I suggest, is the area that is the most difficult for ordinary citizens to find out information about. And it's the area where you have to use your imagination almost to say, what would these other people's positions be? What could they be? And then there's this one, which is pretty straightforward. The news is very good given this. Okay, what's happening? This is the what is happening one. Who's using what tactics when? And it's the easiest, and that's why it's clear very much at the end. That's pretty straightforward. Once you figure out the interests and the perceptions, the tactics become very understandable. And then there's this one. What are you? And I've just put a few. What is your own belief that you carry into understanding these particular conflicts and these situations? And like I said, that's very often, I should do this as a circle. And that's the place to start very often. All right, why am I reacting the way I am? That's a very good question to keep in mind. And I do, what I want to do then tomorrow, dear, if my time is with your time, I do rattle on, don't I? What I want to do tomorrow is more of a systematic approach, if I can, to a very trying, and if you've got any kind of ethical approach to the world that's with a streak of humanitarian sympathy, there's so many problems in the world today. Bosnia happens to be the one that I really want to take apart using this analysis. And then I want to do the Middle East peace agreements. Because I don't know about you, but that's my specialty, the Middle East. And when I started to feel that something positive might happen, that it wouldn't be another war, a sixth war, if you pick one region of the world and one conflict, that there have been more wars since World War II, five major wars in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and now we're working our way out of that. They are, with our help. So that's a good one, and I want to do, before we're done, those two, okay? As sort of the sad one that we hope we work our way out of in the long run, and we will. We will. That one will be contained, but not before, I suspect, a lot more people die. When we start to analyze the interests involved, the two major sides, the Bosnian government / Muslim side, and I keep saying government because there are some Serbs and Croats still in the Bosnian government, which gives them their ideological justification, which is a very interesting one, and so is the Serbian one. That means that neither the Serbs nor the Bosnian government can agree to any of the peace plans thus far. They can't, given their interests. So you know what that means? More war. And dear enough, and it's happening now. The news isn't picking it up. But there are skirmishes and fights all over. So I want to do that and pull it apart a little bit, and then I want to do the Middle East. So I'll have a map and everything tomorrow. And I do apologize for rambling on, but tomorrow we'll start to pull out from people. What is the Serb position? Now, have you found that out if you've been following? What is the Bosnian government position? And I suspect that's the hardest part to get out of people, because that isn't what's covered very well. And it's not a reporter's job to cover it. It's kind of, I guess, up to us as citizens to sort out what I perceive. The State Department doesn't do this very well either, and that's the scary part. And the White House does it almost not at all. The White House comes up with a justification for a policy they think will sell, which is a lot of the reason why newspapers do what they do. They want to sell something, in this case, papers. But, so it's up to us as concerned citizens to say, all right, there's more information out there to be had. Where is it? And hopefully this framework will help us, and tomorrow we'll try that. So thank you for being so patient. Sorry. Yeah, isn't it? Oh, we're supposed to go. Oh, I'm sorry. I have my time. And we pay attention. All right. I have enough. We can do this. Now, remember what I said. If you're going to sort out the interests, we start with geography. Okay, since we kind of have the actors. We have to roll for that. We have France yelling at the United States. Oh, when you start superimposing actors on actors, France never wants to do what we want to do, and we don't ever want it. So we're yelling at each other, and Britain comes in, and they. All right, so we won't do all that right now. We'll start with geography. See, but the primary actors have to be upset about.
Now, that a little bit.
Right. How's that? This is about the best map I found, but it leaves out what the New York Times always puts in, but then I couldn't get that little thing big enough on the thing upstairs. So, we'll do this. Yugoslavia, as you know, is called Union of Slavs. That's what the name of the country was.
South Slavs.
South Slavs. Very good. Although they're not the South Slavs. That's another problem. These guys are the South Slavs. It's getting very different. And it was set up, the country itself, by a decision by Europeans after World War II. And the people in the area did not get to draw their own boundaries. It's a question whether they certainly would have done this, or whether they even would have been united. They had been fighting each other during the war, World War I. And they decided, no, we're going to make this country, and here's because it needs to be viable, and there's all kinds of political influence reasons why. So they set up this all these light-colored area is what was Yugoslavia. And the peoples that live in these various districts, Slovenians, Croatians, Bosnians, who 60 at the time, maybe 60% were Muslim, Montenegrins, most of them using the Cyrillic script like the Serbians do and being Orthodox. Kosovo, which is 90% Albanian, but there's a big mountain range here. So we have some Albanians that got hung on the plateau here, which is easily reachable by Belgrade. This explains a few things. If you actually see the countryside, there's a reason why the border's here. This is the sort of continental divide at the top. And so this is very mountainous here. And as soon as you get down the foothills here, you've got a straight road to Belgrade. So the geographic reason that the border is here. So you've got Albanians. Now you've got Macedonians, but there really isn't a Macedonian language distinct or culture. It was a creation for various political reasons. So the thing of having a Macedonia as a separate Slavic culture is sort of a creation, but really felt by about 500,000 people, and that seems to matter, because now they have their own country. These people don't think they should, these people don't think, but never mind, they do, so there you are. As long as it stays weak, we're all happy. So you've got these folks, whether they're ethnically diverse or not, it is up to your point of view. Then you have lots of Serbs all over here, which is why it's called Serbia. And then you've got Hungarians and Romanians. This is sort of a mushmash. That's why it was made into its own separate part of Yugoslavia, because it isn't a dominant group to be found. This blows. Well, it's not, because it's too tragic to even find it like that. All right, so this all was Yugoslavia. And most people predicted that when democracy would come, it would split. Don't think democracy is the answer to these kinds of conflicts. It exacerbates them in many ways. Because it let out. You know, how do you get elected if you're a Croatian? Here you are, you're living in Zagreb, let's say. There is a thing called Yugoslavia, and democracy is coming, so you want to be a leader. How do you be a leader? You have to get elected. How do you get elected? Often you do not appeal to the more noble in your voters. You may appeal to a strong historic sense of nationalism that's been submerged by communism all these years, which it was. My people have not been having the amount of power economically and politically in Yugoslavia they should. We are justified as being a separate people. Elect me, and I will present your issues, Croatians, our together uniting issues in the larger Yugoslavia, and I won't let them say no.
You can do that in the States.
Oh, yeah. Rather common. You know, way to unite people is appeal to their emotional nationalism, which has been subdued all the 20th century.
As long as Tito was alive, you were a friend of Tito.
That's right. That's the way to get power. But once you eliminate this dictatorship way of getting power, or the Communist Party is the only way to get power, which means you have to love Marx more than anyone else. And, well, not quite, but that's another thing. All right, you eliminate that, what have you got as a way to get yourself elected? This is the one that worked, and this is the one Croatians and Slovenes and all these people used, because these feelings have been so submerged for so long. Now, Europeans have been used to it on the Western European side, and they fought some very ugly wars, and so they don't do that much anymore.
Spell H-A-T-E. It's always there.
Yes, but it has its positive. Look, if that were all the case, then it would be total negative. But let's pause a minute. If you're going to have a viable community, do not the people in that community have to have a commonality, a sense of belonging? Nationalism has its good side. And it's a tenuous thing from an appeal to people, let's be together, let's support each other. There is a positive side to some of these Croatian and Slovenian, whatever appeals. But it's so easy to drift into the other, you know, when some of your followers become very vehement. And then you can be attacked for not being nationalist enough. You know, you get blackmailed by the hate part of your supporters. That's when it's tough. then you better be a good leader. Because if they start saying, you're selling us down the river, you haven't led us strongly enough, you're listening to the Serbs too much, you're listening to Milosevic, who's the president.
No.
So that's why it's hard, see? You know? Yeah.
How much does this map differ from the one that was formed after World War I?
Oh, these are the borders, World War I. And what happened in Yugoslavia is these were the borders that were carved to give these people a recognition for the Yugoslav government. And Tito reinforced them.
No, I'm about to have a World War I.
Yeah, that's when it started. These borders have been there that long. Yes.
There were some adjustments, though, weren't there? Like on the border of Austria, for example?
Well, after World War II, there was a border adjustment here. Yes, there have been some adjustments. Like, that's why there's some Italians, quite a few Italians, living in this as a minority group. Because Italy lost World War II, so we scooped up a little piece of Italy. Oh, yeah, there have been some. That's quite right. But the borders that matter for our purposes are these. And look at them. They're whacked out. No? Oh, boy, if you look at the ex-Soviet Union, you see all kinds of strange borders. Part of that is on purpose. Part of it is to accommodate ethnicity, but part of it is to dilute ethnicity. It's like gerrymandering the United States. And a lot of it was to maximize Serbian territory. Serbians were the dominant power throughout Yugoslavia's history because they're numerically dominant in the entire federation. So when the breakup came,
it's partly because of the geography.
Yes.
Because that's where it's flat, that's where people can live, and so much of the rest.
That's right. It was the place where more people could reproduce these deer because there was more food because it was better terrain.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the Serbians, they would say it's because of their closely knit belief in each other. Economic sex is a problem. So these borders now are the ones being discussed as the country starts to become highly nationalistic and therefore fragile. The decline of the Communist Party and the rise of democracy, unfortunately in Yugoslavia, and I've given only one little indication why, led to fracturing and people's beginning to identify with each other as ethnicity, as the way. And you can kind of, if you have to believe in something, and this whole communist thing you've been fed for so long, which you always sort of suspect is not it. Well, religion. And as soon as you go to religion or nationalism, you begin to see yourself as different if you're a Slovenian Catholic from an Orthodox Serb or from a Muslim Bosnian. Okay? You start to make distinctions.
Aren't there some Lutherans in there
something? I think Leukodinia. Yeah. There's almost everything here. Yeah, you've got a few here from Reformation times, actually. Mm-hmm. Goes back that far.
Calvinists. And from actually more Calvinists.
And from Austrian dominance in this region, there are a few. Although Austria was Catholic since Reformation times. Yeah.
What was the government like in Yugoslavia between the two world wars then?
Dictatorship. After World War I, presumably a parliamentary democracy was set in, a parlamentary democracy, not our presidential kind, and that lasted 2-3 years. And then a dictatorship was established with the real military power. Don't know, do you know the name of the, there was a king for a little period of time.
It was a king who was shot in 1934.
Yeah, and it was actually the generals who dominated. It was a military, Serbian military domination of the state. And that's partly why the Stasi, which is a section of military beliefs in Croatia, was the name that the Croatians who supported the Nazi invasion took. And they did that not because they thought fascism was wonderful or something like that, but because the Serbian military had been running them for so long. See, one bad turn begets another one internationally, particularly when you have history as your justification. Then you can go back to all the time, and as soon as you go back to history and use it, then what are the big events in American history? Wars.
And Hitler held out a big carrot.
Absolutely, power. you will be the controlling Vichy France. You know, they ruled through people.
And we won't do such and such to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which they did. You're right. Right. That's absolutely right.